the question I have is the extent to which you can glean from your sources where the sort of human rights consciousness of these students are coming from, and if there's a demographic element to it. Are they, you know, most of the folks who are coming are engineers, they're in the sciences, so who's becoming activists, and who are the folks who are beginning to develop a sort of human rights critique, and do you get a sense from your sources that any of them are developing that critique in Iran and just coming to the U.S. where they can express themselves, or is this really a sort of diffusion narrative where they're coming to the U.S. or hanging out with, you know, SDSers or whatever, and they're becoming student radicals and then turning their attention back to Iran?
Yeah.
And where's the, is there a biographical or a demographic or some other sort of story to this that explains why human rights becomes the way that they talk about Iran and where it starts?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the demographic element, I'm just not sure about that. But as far as the other question, I think it's both. So, you know, you have, you know, there's one individual who writes a memoir, and he talks about kind of, you know, coming, you know, he goes to school in Oakland in the 1960s and talks about, you know, Black Panthers giving him his first taste of radicalism, and then gets involved in the human rights movement. So there's this, you know, he came over without, you know, without entirely being politically active or in human rights, and it changes because of what's happening in the United States on American campuses in the 1960s. Whereas others, like Kotzebue, who I mentioned earlier, was, you know, his father was Tuda, and he was a courier for, you know, Tuda party members in the 1950s in the post-Mossadegh era, as, you know, essentially the, you know, the Shah's kind of putting the crackdown on, you know, communist organizing in Iran. So he comes to the United States fully politicized.
How does he even get let into the U.S.? I would think that Savak would have been screening those folks who they thought were most likely to criticize the regime when they traveled abroad.
Yeah, well, part of it is that it's an outlet as well.
Yeah.
So if you and he went to Georgetown, he was in the School of Foreign Service in Georgetown. So he, you know, it was a legitimate, you know, reason to go. And, you know, if you're the Shah, I'd imagine there's kind of a calculation: do we keep him in Iran, where, you know, who knows what happens in Iran, or do we, you know, just send him abroad and maybe, you know, things change. You know, I don't know what exactly the decision making was there.
I know this from personal experience. There was an eagerness to send questionable students to America for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because it was in some extent it was easy to surveil them abroad. I mean, there's, you know, what, 18,000 foreign agents in Iran surveilling. They weren't here to surveil Americans. They were here to surveil Iranian students, right? So to some extent, moving them overseas was a perfectly good way to, in fact, increase surveillance on them. But it was also just to get them out. And because I think at some point during the early 1970s, the Shah's regime began to realize that so many of these leftist young people were leaving and not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So it became
a safety valve,
right? As Matthew was saying. So, but I wanted to query you, Matt. There's something that always fascinates me about the Shah, which is how readily he pivoted to human rights discourse or towards the end there. And one thing I've always wondered about this was, who taught him this, right? How did he learn what to say? Who told him? It's like Haile Selassie going in his 1963 speech. Who got to Haile Selassie and said, well, you really should talk about human rights in this speech? Because, yeah, the Shah of Iran didn't care about these things. I don't know if Fadha Divagh, you know, told them about it or who told them about it. But he was so good at it that it really seemed to many Americans could then say, oh yeah, he is the human rights reformer of the future for the Middle East.
Yeah.
And I presume it was some American CIA.
His wife was kind of the proponent, and Ashraf, his sister, was also.
Right.
I mean, she chairs the UN Commission on Human Rights in 1970, which becomes controversy in and of itself. But another thing is that, you know, as far as who told him to do this, you know, I don't know, and I don't think, there's a Gronlich, there's a professor at London School of Economics, Rohan Mavandi, who has been writing about U.S. relationship with Iran in the 1970s, and he shows pretty convincingly that, you know, the Shah very much had a mind of his own. So I don't know if the Shah necessarily needed to be told by somebody. I think he may have been able to pick up on this, you know, that human rights was a way to further his own domestic and international agenda. I mean, in 1976, so after this Savak revelation happens, you know, Kissinger actually makes an inquiry about it through Richard Helms in Tehran. You know, if there are Savak agents in the U.S. who, you know, are violating American laws, then, you know, this needs to stop. It's not good for anybody. And the cable comes back, and the cable says, if you put any restrictions on Savak agents operating in the United States, you know, there are a lot of American intelligence agents collecting, and, you know, on the northern border, a 1,600-mile border with the Soviet Union, who are collecting intelligence in Iran, so we'll restrict their activities. It's essentially, you know, there's nothing you can do about this. So I think the Shah, I mean, he was aware of what he was doing. And, you know, the idea that the Shah was in the United Nations and so well entrenched in the United Nations. So in 1975, you know, once the UN starts to accept petitions from non-state actors, you know, once the UN Commission on Human Rights does, you know, the student movement and other groups are, you know, submit material. And the UN determines in 1970, the report comes out in 76, that no action is needed. Iran's not violating human rights. So this was part of a larger, you know, a larger thing that the Shah and others were very well, you know, they were very aware of, I think. As far as someone maybe giving him that advice, I've never come across, you know, documents where...
But, you know, I mean, like, is there like a dictator seminar of human rights, right? I mean, this is just sort of this, you know, sitting around a table saying, well, if we say this, then, you know, we'll co-opt the human rights movement in our own country and we'll be able to label them as extremists and these sorts of things. It's just the absorption of this human rights discourse by these dictators, it just seems so fluid and fluent sometimes.
Yeah, and there's...
I just wonder where it comes from, right?
I mean, the, you know, Iran has its own human rights organization that it, you know, that operates in the United Nations. There's the women's organization in Iran, which was very prominent. So I don't know where it comes from, and if they're different kind of authoritarian rulers are talking with each other about this, I don't know. But
it's the next conference, the bad faith of human
rights. Right, right.